From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll explore how the idea of citizenship has changed throughout Wisconsin and our nation's history.
Citizenship, which we might take for granted as kind of this ironclad thing, has never existed as a finite political or legal structure. It's something that we as a society get to decide how it shifts.
Then we'll examine what Milwaukee public school teachers are telling the district when they retire or leave for a different job.
Being able to analyze trends in these results and even drill into details can give you a more agile strategy for retaining your qualified staff.
Plus, we'll hear some new songs from local musicians with a nostalgic feeling. All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. Today, President Donald Trump's effort to end birthright citizenship is before the U.S. Supreme Court for oral arguments. What it means to be a citizen has changed throughout U.S. and Wisconsin history, either broadening or constricting the rights of different groups. For WUWM series Making Wisconsin, Our Immigration History, we're taking a long view on how citizenship has evolved over time in our state. To dig into that topic, Eric Vaughn fellow Maria Peralta Arellano spoke with Marquette history professor Sergio Gonzalez.
So I want to take it back to the 1600s. That's kind of when a lot of people and a lot of movements start coming into the state, is around the 1600s. You've called this era the Wild West. Can you kind of explain what you meant by that and how that has to do with how we're classifying citizenship or the movement of people at this time?
Yeah, so I think the important thing to note, of course, is that the question of belonging has existed in this area that we now call Wisconsin, the United States, much longer than before this area was known as those places, right? And so if we think about the arrival of European colonists going back into the 17th century, specifically in the 18th century, they had different ways of understanding how they belong to their nation, which may have been someone like France or the United Kingdom, or how they exist in a relationship to other people who already lived here. So we think here about indigenous populations who have called Wisconsin home for much longer than Wisconsin has actually been a state. People who arrived here who were French or British decide to find themselves not along questions of citizenship, but of subjecthood. In other words, they belonged to the crown, right? And to their relationship to their home country was not defined so much in terms of voting and pieces of paper like a passport, but in terms of dominion and how the crown defined who belonged to those places. And then so we think about the American Revolution in the late 18th century. This is, of course, when American colonists begin to define a new form of political belonging, and this is when they really develop these concept of citizenship, which is to say that individuals who live within a space have the right of self-governance. They get to decide what the boundaries of belonging are, and they also get to decide who gets to belong within those spaces. I think you look moving into places like Wisconsin, specifically in the 1840s and 1850s, you see some of these new states that are popping up that have a very different relationship to citizenship, because during this period of the 19th century, states actually define the parameters of citizenship. The federal government played a pretty minimal role in that process.
So what did statehood mean at this time, and how did that change our ideas of citizenship as we were approaching that possibility and then that certification?
Yeah, so before 1848, when Wisconsin becomes a state, Wisconsin is a territory, and politicians and business leaders here in the territory want to push Wisconsin to become a state. And there is, of course, a numerical threshold you have to hit. In 1836, there were about 11,000 people who lived in Wisconsin, which was much too small, right? And so they had to invite people into this region so they could hit that that threshold so that they could become an actual state to move from territory to statehood. And so one of the things they do is they invite German immigrants into this region beginning into the late 1830s and really into the early 1840s. In 1846 to 1848, the Wisconsin territorial legislature begins to come together to actually craft a constitution, which will eventually be passed in 1848. And if you actually read the original constitution passed in 1848, you see the ways in which immigrants had a certain amount of power here in the state of Wisconsin and the way in which Wisconsin wanted to continue to be a place that could invite immigrants to populate this space, right? So Article 3, which defines suffrage in the state of Wisconsin, in other words, who's allowed to vote. I'm just going to read from it if that's all right, so we can kind of familiarize ourselves, right?
For
so Section 1 reads, every male person of the age of 21 years or upwards who shall have resided in the state for 1 year, next year presiding in the election, shall be deemed a qualified elector at such election, right? So any person, male person, age 21 years or older, who had lived in the state for a year would be allowed to vote in the election. That included, according to Article 3, white persons of foreign birth who shall have declared their intention to become citizens within the next year. You didn't actually have to be a citizen to vote here. That was passed in 1848. Wisconsin had that law on the books until 1908. And but, I'll just note it if I can, right? I mean, there's an important note to say that there are very clear limits on who is allowed to vote in 1848, right? It's these immigrants, but it's specifically white men. In the 1846 proposition, right, so before the 1848 Constitution, in 1846 at the first constitutional convention here in Wisconsin, it was proposed that free black Wisconsinites would also be allowed to vote. It was also proposed that women would be allowed to vote. There are different kind of worlds that could have existed in the 1840s, 1850s here in the state of Wisconsin. But the world in which our kind of forefathers here in the state decided to go with was one in which every male person age 21 years or upwards who was a white man would be allowed to participate in the process of suffrage.
So when did we start really developing those modern institutions and processes we see today that handle immigration and handle citizenship?
Yeah, so to really drive home this point that Wisconsin was a place that was full of economic opportunity, or at least that's the way in which elected officials and business leaders saw the state, and so they really wanted to populate it. One of the ways in which the state of Wisconsin tried to entice people to come to this region and really bring them into the state was through actual government institutions. So in 1852, the Wisconsin State Legislature actually creates the Wisconsin Office of Emigration, right? They actually allocate money. They create an emigration officer whose responsibility is to go to New York City and wait at the wharfs. Like, he's actually waiting at the docks, passing out literature, publicizing the state of Wisconsin and how wonderful the opportunities are here. So they were specifically looking for German immigrants, British immigrants, Welsh immigrants, and Scandinavian immigrants to come to Wisconsin, people who they felt would be comfortable in the state because of the population that already lived here and because they felt like parts of Wisconsin kind of replicated what life was like in Europe for some of these populations. So that office exists in different formats throughout the 19th century, right? Sometimes it's defunded, and then it comes back. And we can see the way in which that funding happens for the Office of Immigration depending on waves of nativism that are sweeping across the country. So at those moments that Americans become very anxious about the growing immigrant population, there's a backlash, right? So in the 1840s and 1850s, there's something called the Know-Nothing Party, which is this anti-immigrant party that is pushing to kind of close the borders of the nation to European immigration. And the office is defined at that time. And this office kind of exists and fits and starts throughout the 19th century, really represents the way in which Wisconsin was trying to recruit a very specific type of person to the state. And it really ends in the early 20th century when immigration becomes a much more nationalized issue, right? And so in the late 19th century, the U.S. Congress passes a series of laws, the first sets of exclusionary laws, which mean to basically shut the border to Chinese immigrants who are arriving, looking to work in the U.S. West. And then the early 20th century, the federal Congress begins to introduce a series of laws that really begin to tighten who is allowed to come to the country, under what circumstances, what type of education a person has, what access to money they might have, what their relationship to work might be. And so by the early 20th century, what had been a state issue, right, where individual states took up a lot of that work, has now become a federal issue. And the U.S. Congress is now really setting the parameters by which a person is allowed into the country and by which they may become a citizen of the nation as well.
I'm WWM's Maria Peralta Arellano speaking with Marquette History Professor Sergio Gonzalez. I kind of want to bring up the 14th Amendment. It's something that's been popping up a lot lately in our modern conversations of citizenship. So the 14th Amendment gave way to birthright citizenship specifically for formerly enslaved people in 1867. So how did this shift the idea of who is American?
Yeah, so the 14th Amendment is this effort by Congress to finally address this issue of black citizenship in the nation, right? I mean, this is, of course, the driver for the Civil War. The 14th Amendment, of course, begins that process of dismantling the institution of slavery, but also building up this concept of federal citizenship, which is to say that a person who was born in the United States is granted with that question of citizenship, no questions asked. Right. And so that, however, doesn't really define what citizenship is. It just says who a citizen is in its founding in the 14th Amendment. And so the history really of everything since the establishment of the 14th Amendment has been a question of how Americans have grappled with the what citizenship actually entails, right? And who actually has access to all of those different pieces, whether it's questions of who can own property, who can vote, who can have a passport, and the relationships to the state. That has continued to be worked out. And of course, we know today in 2025 that even the concept of birthright citizenship for some Americans continues to be an open question. Although for the courts, it is certainly not. It has been adjudicated or re-adjudicated so many times that it seems to have just been established law. But we are living in times where that might be questioned.
With the questioning of birthright citizenship, the Bracero program in the 1940s, bringing in temporary workers from Mexico to fill labor shortages during war times. We also had migrant workers. Many of them were Tejano, which is a unique identity in the rainbow of Latino identities. So how did these people, these groups, how did that play into the conversation of citizenship and then also the program itself?
Yeah. So, you know, 1940s, the United States has entered into World War II. It's in dire need of workers. And so the United States looks down to Mexico as well as a series of other Latin American Caribbean nations to help it do the work of filling its farms and its factories. And so according to this agreement signed between the United States and Mexico in 1942, the U.S. is allowed to functionally import labor from Mexico. And these individuals sign these limited-term contracts in Mexico, right? And they're sent up by train. They're brought up all across the United States. Many of them work in places like California and Texas. But Wisconsin also becomes home to braceros, to these Mexican farm workers in the 1940s and 1950s. I think the important thing to note is that these people are brought up for only one reason, that is to work. And so when they sign these contracts, they are being brought up as what is often referred to as guest workers. And the United States has had guest worker programs all the way into the early decades of the 20th century. But the Bracero program kind of represents this really rapid escalation and this kind of really big growth in this program. These workers, when they arrive in the United States, they have this really tenuous stance in the country because the contracts that they've signed with the United States and Mexico is supposed to afford them rights as laborers, but it affords them no rights as citizens, right? So they're certainly not allowed to vote. There is no pathway to citizenship for them. And really, their sort of political voice is very much constrained. And that plays out pretty clearly in their working situations. I mean, these are kind of situations that are ripe for exploitation, and that's what happens to these Mexican farm workers. It also, unfortunately, also depresses wages here for American farm workers in the United States. And so there's an immediate blowback among American farmers who see the Bracero program as a way to strip their ability to unionize and to bargain for their own wages. And so these guest worker programs, which have existed in our country and continue to exist in this country today, are very complicated labor programs, but they also speak to the questions of citizenship. What does it mean to only exist in this country as a worker and never have a pathway to citizenship, to never have a pathway to full inclusion of political belonging in this country? That kind of plays out with the Mexican-American farm workers you mentioned, these Texas Mexicans, Tejano farm workers, who are American citizens. They arrive in Wisconsin at the exact same time. And even though they are American citizens, they often find that they're treated the exact same way as these Bracero workers are treated, which is to say like second-class or no-class citizens at all. And so they're petitioning for better working conditions, better living conditions, often without any sort of reprieve, really not until the 1960s when they're able to build effective social movements to push back against these labor systems.
We're mentioning a lot of times that things are coming in waves. Is there any place in history where we can kind of see similar thoughts and feelings towards citizenship that we're seeing now?
Yeah, I think, you know, Mark Twain is famous for having said, you know, at least apocryphally, that history doesn't repeat itself, it just rhymes, right? And so we can see parallels, it never lays on so perfectly. But I think historians have kind of pointed to the 1920s as an era that seems starkly familiar today. You know, we're 100 years away from that, a period of rising nativism where Americans, at least voting Americans, have become quite anxious about what they believe to be the changing demographics of the nation. And they feel that the United States has a responsibility to respond to that. And so what that has led to, at least in the last presidential election, has been the invitation of a very specific executive power that believes it has the right to continue to constrain the boundaries of citizenship and boundaries of belonging in the United States. And of course, we're seeing that play out every single day here in 2025, which is to say that people who perhaps could have taken it for granted that they had protections in this country, legal protections, no longer feel safe. Right? And that's played out a lot of different ways. It's not just undocumented immigrants in this country who now are afraid of their status in this country and a sense of belonging. It's people who have access to things like temporary protected status. It's people who are resident aliens in the nation. It's students who are here on visas who we have seen in the news, of course, have been functionally abducted in broad daylight by immigration and customs officers. And I think the important thing to know, of course, then is that citizenship, which we might take for granted as kind of this ironclad thing, has never existed as a finite political or legal structure. It's something that we as a society get to decide how it shifts. And that can be both something that can be constraining, in other words, that we can think about a smaller group of people who can be included in citizenship. But alternatively, that also means that we can have the imagination to think about a world in which the concept of citizenship is broader, that more people can see themselves within the boundaries of belonging in our nation or in our local communities.
A lot of people also point to the fact that there's also tribal citizenship and tribal sovereignty. What is the difference for the people who may not be familiar, and how are we factoring that now also into our conversation of citizenship and who belongs?
Yeah, so Wisconsin is home to a series of Native tribes that have politically recognized sovereign rights in this nation, which means that they have their own form of citizenship within the nation, but they're also citizens of the United States. And I think we might take it for granted in 2025 that this has been the way that it is for quite some time. But in fact, it's a relatively new concept that has taken a long time to be figured out. And it has come at the expense, of course, of Native tribes' ability to live in the place that they wanted to live. And so Wisconsin doesn't exist as a state in 1848 without the displacement of many Native peoples who called this place home for millennia before that. And then, of course, the establishment of reservation spaces where people's political belonging and the right to exist is kind of confined within very specific locations, whether it's in the state of Wisconsin or moving westward outside of what was once this territory and later the state. And so the thing that I always emphasize when I talk about the Indian Citizenship Act of 1924, is that the question of citizenship is often, we think of it as something that people are striving for, but it can be also something that's imposed. And so, you know, this is something that when Congress passes the Indian Citizenship Act of 1924, they're imposing a sense of citizenship on a group of people that have a very complicated relationship to citizenship, both because of this long history of displacement and of political disempowerment, but also because these sovereign nations have a relationship to their own political citizenship within the boundaries of their own native nation states.
What are the pros and cons of someone who is newly being factored into citizenship?
Yeah, I think, you know, citizenship offers you protections, right? I mean, it and we see this today in 2025 when people who are, you know, legal permanent residents or visa holders who are not citizens realize that that's a very important distinction. Right, the fact that the state can enact certain legal procedures and, in fact, enact violence against you because you're not a citizen. So I think one of the most important things is that it protects you from the federal government. But I think just to think of citizenship as kind of this black and white space of like whether or not you're protected rips apart some of those other aspects of what it means to belong in a place like the United States, which is to say that there are plenty of people who want citizenship because it allows them to claim a sense of belonging in this nation, right? And so if you were to go to a naturalization ceremony in Milwaukee or across this country, you would see people who have gone through quite a process. All right, people who have left their home country and who have made the conscious decision to become American citizens. And that brings with it a lot of weight, a lot of pressures, perhaps the abandonment of something, but also the creation of something new. And I think the expectation, the hope is that once you achieve that questions of American citizenship, that it will also bring entry into the larger body of the nation and the community that you now call home. The reality, of course, is that people have always had varied relationships to citizenship, even when they've been able to achieve it.
So President Trump, we've talked about it earlier, has proposed the end of birthright citizenship. What was your reaction to that?
As a historian, it wasn't surprising because there has been a movement among a very small set of jurists, but most importantly, people who are not themselves lawyers. And this has been bubbling now for decades of individuals who have tried to redefine what the 14th Amendment actually means and jurisprudence that has existed now for a century, right? Which is to say that, as I mentioned earlier, this is supposed to be settled law. What I think has been surprising has been the fact that the Supreme Court has not quickly shut that conversation down. I mean, it's an active conversation right now within the jurisprudence, right, within the law. And so we will see what the Supreme Court says. I am hopeful that this is kind of a red line that will not be crossed. But on the other hand, so much is changing on the ground that it's hard to say what will actually stand in 2025. I believe that if birthright citizenship is stripped, there's going to be a lot that has to be rethought in this country. I mean, it's not just a question of who gets to belong and who gets to be a citizen, but then it's questions of who is going to be expelled from the nation and what is the relationship to these people who overnight lose their access to citizenship. What will that actually look like? I think it's a black box that most Americans would prefer not to grapple with, but we will see if it's something that we have to deal with.
Sergio Gonzalez is a history professor at Marquette University. He spoke with WUWM's Eric Vaughn Fellow, Maria Peralta Arellano. That was part of our series, Making Wisconsin Our Immigration History. You can find all of those conversations that aired this week at WUWM.com. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast to download and listen on demand. Later in the show, we'll bring you some new local music in this month's Milwaukee Music Roundup. But first, we'll take a look at some reporting by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that examines exit survey data from Milwaukee Public Schools teachers. That's coming up on Lake Effect on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Milwaukee's public school district is sitting on a valuable trove of data. Nearly 900 employees who have left in the last 5 years took time to write down their thoughts about why they were quitting. But reporting by Milwaukee Journal Sentinel education reporter Lori Linane found that MPS doesn't analyze or report out its exit survey data. This leaves questions about why educators leave the district and how MPS can improve. Linane joins WUWM education reporter Catherine Kokel to talk about her reporting and what comes next.
Let's start with your reporting and what you found. You reviewed almost 900 handwritten exit surveys from staff who left Milwaukee Public Schools between 2021 and 2024. What were some of those staff members' top reasons for leaving the school district?
Yeah, a lot of staff talked about a lack of support and having increasingly high workloads in their jobs. So it ties into the focus of my project, which is looking at vacant staff positions in Milwaukee Public Schools. And so a lot of the staff who are still there talked about how that weighs on their own jobs and they're having to cover other duties as well as their own. And that can add up and cause burnout. And that was one of the big trends we saw among people who were leaving MPS.
I believe someone even shared that they spent multiple hours a day covering two other jobs that were empty in their school. So they were not only burnt out from covering their duties, but also covering vacancies that already existed, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Sometimes when a school can't find a full-time teacher for a position, other teachers will have to help out with those classes when they might usually be having a prep period or, on their breaks, they're having to fill in for other people. And, you know, in addition to vacancies, a lot of people just talked about feeling like they didn't have enough, budgeted staff positions in their schools either, like not enough social workers or counselors, psychologists, the people who help students just have a good school experience and be able to focus on their classwork. So teachers really felt the absence of support staff like that and felt like they had to try to, make up the difference and be those people for their students too.
So it's also important to note that exit surveys are not required. People only fill them out if they choose to. And also, they're not anonymous, so anything that someone shares is attached to their name. That being said, what did people say could have kept them there? What needed to improve in order for them to stay?
Yeah, that is one of the questions on the survey, asking them what could have kept them there. So not everyone filled out that question, but of the people who did, we saw a lot of comments about wanting the job to be closer to how it used to be, having like smaller class sizes, more support. A lot of teachers mentioned wanting to have the support of paraprofessionals in their rooms. And overall, just I think a common thread was feeling like if they had more support, they might have stayed longer. Some people mentioned that they were retiring, but would have, stayed longer if they had that support. And other people were going to other districts or to other career paths because they just felt like they couldn't last in in their jobs any longer.
So what does MPS do with this information from these exit surveys? That's kind of the crux of your reporting, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, not as much as could be done with the feedback. The forms are still done on paper. And so there are assistants in the HR office who will log their answers. And then, from what I heard from the former human resources director, she would, like scan through them. And if anything caught her eye, she might bring that up with like a principal or a regional superintendent. But there wasn't an overall analysis of the trends in these exit surveys. So some other school districts will do an analysis on their exit surveys so that they can say, more staff this year than last year left because they were concerned about safety. And then, like, they can really dig into the reasons behind that and what maybe they could do to help improve staff retention. So that's an area that MPS hasn't really explored. They've talked about it, and they actually did pilot a digital exit survey that would allow them to do that kind of analysis. But that it seems they lost the data from that pilot project. So they haven't really done that robust analysis.
And this impacts more than just how it feels to work at MPS, right? Previous reporting from the Journal Sentinel found that vacancies in MPS schools disproportionately impact students who come from lower income backgrounds, students with disabilities, and students of color.
Yeah, and my previous reporting, we did find that vacancies are disproportionate across the school district. And from what I've heard from staff in those schools is they feel under-resourced, and they feel students in those schools are coming to school with more needs, facing more challenges in their lives, and not getting that matched support in their school environment. So some school districts and some states have more like equity-based funding formulas that take different needs into account. And Milwaukee and Wisconsin don't have funding formulas like that. And so yeah, some staff feel like that leads to an inequitable resource distribution across the district and makes the jobs harder in schools where students are coming to school with more challenges, and that causes more turnover in those schools, and it causes the working conditions and the learning conditions to be more difficult for both the students and the staff in those schools.
As you were reviewing the results from these exit surveys, what came through to you? Did people want to stay?
Yeah, it's a really good question because there's also the exit survey also asked them what they like about working for MPS, and a lot of people also filled that out with really strong statements about how much they cared about the students in their school, how much they cared about their colleagues. A lot of them were clearly really passionate about the job that they were doing. In some cases, they said it had become too much for their health, their mental health, in some cases their physical health, taking too much of a strain on their families. And so it seemed like there was a lot of, I guess, tension that people were feeling between wanting to stay in these jobs that they really cared about, but feeling like it wasn't something they could do any longer.
MPS has a new superintendent in Dr. Brenda Caselius. What did she say when you talked to her about these exit surveys?
Well, she is very new to the district, so she, wasn't part of setting up how this functions right now. And she did say that going forward, she does feel they should have a much stronger exit survey process. She recently called in the Council of the Great City Schools to do a review of the whole human resources department and operations. So she's hoping this will be part of that. And regardless, she said, in general, she wants to see stronger surveys of staff, not only when they're leaving, but throughout their experience at MPS. She'd like to have kind of more of a pulse on how staff are feeling about different issues. We'll see if that gets implemented. But it sounds like that is her goal, is to have a digitized, more detailed survey for staff throughout their experience and when they leave.
And why is it important that school districts pay attention to these exit surveys?
Well, I think you can find pretty much any principal or administrator around the country, and people will talk about how hard it is to find and retain qualified staff in schools right now. And so retention is a huge piece of that, and you have to understand why people are leaving in order to have a good retention strategy. And so, like for example, in Fond du Lac, they redid their exit survey process recently, and they have been able to analyze the results. And they found, specifically for teachers who were leaving their careers early on in their careers, they were saying they weren't getting enough mentorship, enough guidance on the job. And so the district decided to create three new positions for people who are coaching these new teachers. And they said that's really made a difference and helped them feel confident staying in the profession longer. So I think, being able to analyze trends in these results and even drill into details to say, like, specifically what are new teachers saying, specifically what are paraprofessionals or safety assistants saying, can give you a more agile strategy for retaining your qualified staff.
So there are places in which this data is being put to work and leading to changes in other school districts, including in Wisconsin.
Right. Some other states have done this as a statewide project, where they, like in Ohio, they developed a model exit survey that school districts could then adopt for free so they wouldn't have to develop their own. And then that's helpful too, because there's consistency across school districts in some cases, and you can kind of compare where you stand. We don't have that in Wisconsin, but some school districts have taken it upon themselves to really modernize their exit surveys.
From one education reporter to another, thank you so much for this reporting and for sharing it with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rory Linane is an education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She spoke with WUWM's education reporter, Catherine Kokol. Linane is finishing up a year-long reporting fellowship where she looked at vacancies within Milwaukee's public schools alongside contributing reporters and Marquette University students Gabriel Cicerica and Chesney Wardell. We've got a new season of Bulber Talk on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area that you've always wondered about at WUWM.com. Festival season is just around the corner. We'll help you prepare by sharing what local acts you might see on the lineups this summer. Milwaukee Music Roundup is next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. As the weather gets warmer, many of us are looking forward to getting back outside. But this time of year is very special for Milwaukee Records' Matt Wild. It's the season where festivals announce their lineup of musical acts and when he prepares for a full summer of new local music. Every month, Wild joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about some of the best new music from local musicians. This month, he shares a few songs with a bit of a nostalgic edge.
So this is one of those lists of songs where you go, there is so much happening in the city of Milwaukee. All of these songs are wildly different and really well produced.
Absolutely, yeah. I think a lot of these songs, they kind of, not to put down Milwaukee, but I know we've said this before where it's like you hear the song and you're like, oh, this is coming out of Milwaukee? Wow, that's pretty great. Not that it should be a surprise at this point, but, you know, there is that little thought. So the first song we're going to listen to is a new one by a fantastic group called 5 p.m. to Nowhere. And they have a new single out. It is called One More Chance. Now, 5 p.m. to Nowhere, earlier this year, they put out a EP. It was called City of Light, Act One. And it was kind of a throwback, kind of a moody, kind of Coldplay-esque, kind of 2010s-esque indie pop song. And now they are back with this new track. It is called One More Chance. And this is from their upcoming, guess the name of this, it's called City of Light, Act Two. This one is, I think, a really fantastic song. It's a little jangly. It's a little more upbeat. I think it's fantastic. This is a group that has been around for maybe 3-4 years at this point, and I think are really kind of coming into themselves. I really like the vibe of this track. It's giving me a little bit, just a touch of, like, you know, something like the Gin Blossoms or maybe even, oh, I don't know, Toad the Wet Sprocket, something like that. So this is 5 p.m. to Nowhere with One More Chance.
One More Chance by 5 p.m. to Nowhere. The next song we have, it's really interesting. It reminds me kind of early MIA. It really reminds me of an artist who I listen to. I don't exactly know how to say their name. Noga Eras, I think.
Yes.
If you're familiar with them, it's very dancey in a way. It has a really great beat.
Yeah, it has a really brassy kind of upbeat beat, and it is the latest from Zed Kenzo. Now, Zed Kenzo, a former Milwaukee artist. Zed Kenzo was here for many, many years, put out a lot of fantastic albums, EPs, and singles. And in the last few years, I believe she's currently out on the East Coast, I believe, perhaps the Boston area. So she's been out there doing her thing. But she's one of those artists that I identify so much with Milwaukee. And this is the latest from Zed. It is called Marvelous. And she's put out a few tracks kind of over the last few months, but haven't heard a ton from her. So it's nice to hear a new track. And I think it's, you know, as the title says, it is a marvelous song. And yeah, definitely one of those like, oh, wow, this sounds like the real, real deal. And it's great to hear from her again. It's I hope she's doing well. Milwaukee misses her. This is the latest from Zed Kenzo. It is called Marvelous. I think I went high.
hide it in the pain like a flag. Since I was little, my mama told me I'm a star. Coco on the beat, going black, da, da. 80 to 100, don't be a fan of my car. I'm self-official, I very certified. Was a blue check, verified in real life. Never artificial, you can look into my eye. Bonafide, you ain't even gotta think twice. Knock 'em out, left hook.
Knock 'em out.
Level up. Should be tying up loose ends. Go ahead and elevate. You ain't gotta hate. When you on a pedestal, eat it up the whole plate. Go ahead, you better slay. What they gotta say? Go ahead, you better slay. Huh, what they gotta say? Knock 'em out, left hook.
Knock 'em out.
Wow.
Marvelous by Zed Kenzo. The next song we're going to look at, it very much sounds to me like the song you'd hear at a crucial part in a mid-2000s kind of coming-of-age rom-com, if that makes sense.
That makes complete sense, and that is exactly what this group is going for. This is the latest song from a group, a Milwaukee group called Alley Eyes, and the song is No Good. Now, Alley Eyes are really kind of on the forefront of the resurgence of a little bit of a genre called indie sleaze. And indie sleaze is very much a kind of early to mid-aughts thing. Think of bands like The Strokes. Think of bands like The Killers or LCD Sound System. Groups like that that were really active in the early aughts and up till the 2010s. And there is a bit of kind of national resurgence for that kind of indie sleaze, very much defined by, you know, jean jackets and dive bars and, you know, smoking cigarettes and dive bars. So here's Alley Eyes kind of bringing it back to Milwaukee. Some may say that Milwaukee has never left its indie sleaze phase, or it has always been an indie sleaze kind of town. But I think Alley Eyes, they're doing a great job. Earlier this year, they put out a track called Tangerines. And this one is a little more anthemic and absolutely right. It does have kind of a credit sequence kind of vibe to it. I really, really like this song. And it's one that kind of caught me off guard. I was like, oh, I really, really like this track. So, yes, it is the latest from Alley Eyes, and it is called No Good.
I'm feeling insufficient. I'm a flag that's had half mess. I'm feeling that additions. Cigarette butt shattered glass. I'm no good. The things we did, the way you taste, and now my God, now I still be there. The ways we move, and now hearts race at night.
No Good by Alley Eyes. The final song we're going to listen to, it also feels like a bit of a throwback. It reminds me a bit maybe of Cage the Elephant or Dr. Dog, one of those kinds of mid-late 2000s groups, very indie again.
Yeah, very indie. A lot of, kind of throwback indie this episode, and definitely a little bit of Elliot Smith in this as well. This is the latest from a group called Witty Remarks, and the song we're going to be listening to is called Heal Harms. And it's from Witty Remarks' new album called Nary a Care. Now, Witty Remarks is Travis and Ashley Witty. And this song, Heal Harms, in this album, Nary a Care, is dedicated to Travis's father, who passed away in 2020. And it is an album that is very, very much grappling with the loss of his father. it's not like a sad, bleak album, but it is. It's very melancholy, and it's just a lovely piece of work. The opening track features kind of a voicemail left from Travis's father, left to him before he passed, and it's like I said, it's hard to critique an album like this, except to say that it is lovely. There are a lot of fantastic Milwaukee musicians on this album and on this track. People like Barry Paul Clark, Chris Porterfield from Field Report plays pedal steel, I believe, on the song we're going to be listening to. And this song, Heal Harms, it kind of features a great lyric at the end that really sums up kind of the grieving process. Let it all move you. The only way out is through. And I think that's just a very kind of simple and very profound thing to say about the grieving process. So this is a beautiful album from Witty Remarks. The album is called Nary a Care, and the song is called Heal Harms.
By Witty Remarks. We are really in, I'm going to say summer. I know it's still spring, but we are really on the cusp of summer here in Milwaukee. The weather's getting beautiful out, more consistently warm. What are you looking forward to?
Well, for me, this time of year is the festival announcement season. Very distinct from spring and very distinct from summer, because for about 3 weeks, every single day, the summer festivals are announcing their lineup. So that really keeps me and my partner, Milwaukee Record, Tyler Moss, that keeps us on our toes. So this is a very exciting time of year for us. And yes, I mean, looking forward to, I mean, here it comes. Once June kicks in, it's on. June 1st, right away, is Locust Street Festival on that first Sunday of June. And then there's Pride stuff. And then there's just everything else. I'm looking forward to all of it. I try not to get overwhelmed before it even begins, but that always does kind of happen. So right now I'm enjoying the few brief weeks before the storm hits. But yeah, I'm really, really looking forward to this summer.
Very nice. Well, Matt Wild, as always, thank you for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
Matt Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record. Every month, he joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about some of the best new music from local bands. At WUWM.com, you can find all of their previous conversations. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and Excrit Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Jimmy Gutierrez, Eddie Morales, Catherine Kokel, and Maria Peralta Arellano from the WUWM News Team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager, Valera Navarra-Viegas is our digital editor, Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon when we'll look at Anodyne Coffee Workers' efforts to unionize. Plus, we'll learn about the Milwaukee Philatelic Society, one of the oldest stamps collecting organizations in the country. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.